Hello, my name is Herzl Hefter, and our talk this morning is entitled Hinduism and Chassidut. And the truth is, the title itself is very surprising, and I find myself being surprised that I'm speaking about this, because I've been studying Chassidut for quite a while, and the thought that there may be a connection between a movement which arose in Eastern Europe in the 18th century and a civilization in Central East Asia, namely India, Hinduism is a very old and ancient religion, that which is generally associated in the Western mind, in the Jewish mind, with being idolatrous, with its many idols and a plethora of gods, that there should be any connection between those, between the Hasidic movement and Hinduism is surprising. But some things that are surprising are actually clearly true in any case. The historical connection, what may or may not be a historical connection, is beyond the scope of our talk. But I would like to share with you a number of different sources, which we will see that that not only do Hasidic sources and Hindu sources grapple with the same issues, but they grapple with the same issues in the same way, sometimes using even the same language. So I would like to start by comparing a passage written by Shankara, who was an Indian philosopher in the 8th century. Now, Shankara, just to give people some context, Shankara is equivalent to the Rambam, what the Rambam, Maimonides, is for us. And he's very mainstream, he's a very mainstream interpreter of sacred Hindu texts. So in this passage, which is a commentary on the Brahma Sutra, Shankara says as follows, and then we're going to compare this to something that we find in the Baal Shem Tov. So Shankara says as follows. He has a metaphor. A man may, in the dark, mistake a piece of rope lying on the ground for a snake and run away from it, frightened and trembling. Thereon, another man may tell him, "Do not be afraid. It is only a rope, not a snake." And he may then dismiss the fear caused by the imagined snake and stop running. But all the while, the presence and subsequent absence of his erroneous notion as to the rope being a snake make no difference whatever in the rope itself. Exactly analogous is the case of the individual I, which is in reality one with the Atman. We could call that the universal consciousness or God, although avidya makes it appear different. Okay, let's just explain what we have here. A person mistakes. This is the metaphor. A person mistakes a rope for a snake. The cause of his mistake is ignorance. When someone instructs him, enlightens him, so then he understands that what was here was in fact a rope and not a snake. And his knowledge or his impression of whether of the reality did not change the reality itself. It was always a rope. And he was merely ignorant. And what he's saying here then is that reality is, minimally speaking, is not as it appears. And reality as it appears to us is a product of ignorance. And this means as well that people, what are people ignorant of? They're ignorant of reality, but they're also ignorant of their own nature. I'll read the last line again. Exactly analogous is the case of the individual I, which is in reality one with the Atman, although avidya makes it appear different. Actually, they may look upon a rope and mistake it for a snake. This metaphor alludes to the reality which a person senses themselves as being autonomous and individuated, the individual I sense myself as being, which is independent of the rest of reality. And this is an erroneous perception. Exactly analogous is the case of the individual I, which in reality is one with the Atman. That's one with, in this case, maybe, say, the collective consciousness, or God, although avidya makes it appear different. Avidya is a concept which best translated means lack of knowledge, lack of understanding, or ignorance. So there is, human beings are ignorant as to the true nature of themselves and the true nature of the world, and there is an illusion, which elsewhere is referred to as the Maya. There is an illusion in which we generally live. Okay, so that's Shankara in the 8th century. Now I would like to read a story to you from the Baal Shem Tov. Okay. The Baal Shem Tov says as follows. This is quoted by a number of his disciples. This would be by his grandson who wrote the Degel Machne Ephraim. This appears in the end of the volume on the commentary on Rosh Hashanah. Okay? Because this is something, this is a parable that the Baal Shem Tov used to tell before Tkiat Shofar, before the blowing of the Shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Okay? So let's see how this is quoted. I heard a parable from my master, my grandfather, blessed be his memory, referring to the Baal Shem Tov. A king made many screens by means of illusion, one within the other. And between each wall he put rivers and many terrifying armies, and also bears and lions and other terrifying beasts, so that the people would fear to go to him. Yeah. Now, I'm skipping a little bit. And the king is awesome, and his kingship is prevailing everywhere. And the light of his face, the face of the king, illuminates all the worlds, and his glory fills the earth. But the walls of the encompassing things are hiding the face of the king. And this is realized by dint of the illusion. Okay, so now I'm explaining. Here also we have a reality which is described as an illusion, where the true reality is something which we do not in general comprehend, and that is the face of the king. In other words, the fact that God is the true reality, and he has constructed a palace with walls and terrifying beasts which scare people away. And now I'll continue reading. So the walls and the encompassing things are hiding the face of the king, and this is realized by dint of the illusion. And the heralds go out saying, whoever will come to the king, he will give him riches and honor, and he will become an official of his, standing in his palace. And who does not want it? And when he comes to the first wall, when anybody comes to the first wall and sees its length and height and the other things that terrify the hearts, okay, they're afraid. Right? Now I'm skipping again a little bit. And by power of his burning and broken heart, he wants to come close to his father. Okay? And he offers himself, that's mesirut nefesh, right? He's willing to sacrifice himself, a tremendous amount of dedication, and compels himself to leap over the walls and the rivers to spread the riches of the armies that are surrounding there. And when his father sees his longing and devotion, etc., the father then, the king, removes all the illusions, and he sees that there is no wall, nor a separating screen, but plain land and gardens and orchard and play and palaces for pleasure. And the servants of the king stand in splendid garments, etc., etc. So we have a devoted servant or son struggling through all the obstacles, which are illusions, to reach the king. And when he reaches the king, the illusions evaporate. And then he perceives a different reality. Now, these two stories, right, are not only separated by a continent, but they're also separated by close to 1,000 years. But nonetheless, their similarity is striking. We have Shankara, who, well, there's a question of interpretation here, which I would like to get into, but let's take the first level. We have Shankara, who says that, in minimally speaking, that the reality, the way it is perceived, is not true, is an illusion. And it is ignorance that generates that illusion. And similarly, we have in the Baal Shem Tov that the reality which we perceive, namely the palace with all its surroundings, are in fact an illusion which hide God's face. Okay? Now, what's interesting, what's further interesting here, is that Shankara can be interpreted in a number of ways. And here, I just want to take two different interpretations. And we'll see there are similar different interpretations in understanding the Baal Shem Tov. Shankara can be saying really one of two things. There's a famous India scholar who came to the United States from Germany in 1940. He died a short time afterwards. He was at Columbia University. His name was Heinrich Zimmer. He, by the way, wrote an amazing book, which I strongly recommend to anybody interested in the subject, called Myth and Symbol in Indian Art and Civilization. That's by Heinrich Zimmer, Z-I-M-M-E-R. In any case, he says that even though, going back to the Shankara metaphor, the person is looking at a rope, but he perceives a snake, and that's a mistake. But it's not that there's nothing there. There is, in fact, a rope there. So what Shankara is saying, according to this, is that it is not that reality itself is an illusion, but reality is not what it seems to be. And that's different. There is something real out there. There is a rope. It's just in general it is mistaken, or maybe mistaken, for a serpent. But once you get past your mistaken perceptions, you do see a reality which is this worldly, right? So there is a rope. On the other hand, Wendy Doniger, who was a professor at the University of Chicago, who wrote a book called The Hindus. There, she offers a different interpretation. She says that when the person in the Shankara metaphor becomes aware that what they are looking at is in fact a rope and not a snake, it brings them to question their very perceptions altogether. And it may be that there is no world at all. So Shankara is open here to interpretation. Similarly, the story of the Baal Shem Tov is open to interpretation, because we have a metaphor. What is the metaphor in the Baal Shem Tov? We have God creates a palace, which is an illusion. And when the person transcends all the hurdles of the illusion, he reaches God. What is the palace in the metaphor? Well, I think our first inclination would be to say that the palace is the world. And that would bring us into closer to what Shankara is saying, that the palace is the world created. Now, this is very interesting, because it's created by dint of illusion as almost magically. Right, that is the language that the Baal Shem Tov uses. It is created like magic, made by it's in Hebrew it's called achizat einayim, magic. The word maya in Sanskrit, which is the illusion of the world, also means magic. In other words, the gods created our perceptions of the world almost the way a magician creates, the way a magician creates an illusion. And that is in common, very strongly in common, in the imagery, again, of Shankara and what the Baal Shem Tov is saying. But let's get back to the different ways of interpreting the Baal Shem Tov. What is the palace? One may say that the palace is the world, and that's what we just said. And that means what the Baal Shem Tov is saying is that the world itself is an illusion. And now, admittedly, it's hard to understand this, and we'll flesh this out later. The world is an illusion. Another way of interpreting the Baal Shem Tov is seeing what he says in context. He used to tell this parable before the blowing of the shofar on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah. What was the purpose of the parable in that context? He's fighting what's called in Chassidut machshavot zarot, foreign, alien thoughts. A person is trying to pray. A person is trying to listen to the blowing of the shofar and to connect with it and to concentrate on it. And all sorts of thoughts, uncontrollable thoughts, pop into their heads, and they begin, and their minds begin to wander. This is something that Chassidim are very concerned about. It was the whole idea of praying with proper intent and controlling your thoughts. So, but everybody fails because nobody can control their thoughts, and we always wind up thinking about other things. So the other interpretation of the Baal Shem Tov is that the palace is not the world. The palace are the alien thoughts, the distracted thoughts that people have during prayer or during the blowing of the shofar. And what he's saying is that you may think that these thoughts take you away from God, where in fact the thoughts are an illusion. The thoughts are created by God in order that you should be able to struggle and overcome them. So they are part of the spiritual process. And that, of course, is a very well-known Hasidic idea, that the darkness and the physicality and the sensuousness and all the things that we desire in the world that are not necessarily the best things, in God resides in that as well. And they are instrumental in a higher purpose. So we have two ways of understanding the Baal Shem Tov as well. So we see that a parallel where not only is our Shankara and the Baal Shem Tov grappling with a certain spiritual reality, but they're also talking about it the same way, and they are also open to parallel types of interpretation. So that's the first pair of sources which I wanted to share with you.
So we have here the Baal Shem Tov, and we have Shankara. So there's something about the world which is either because God is the only one that exists, and therefore the world doesn't really exist, and that's a strange idea for us. I'll try to flesh that out a little bit in a minute. And the other possibility is that the world does exist, but it isn't what it seems. Right? The one who actually says in Hasidic thought that the world doesn't exist at all is, in fact, the Baal HaTanya. Right? Surprisingly, the Baal HaTanya is the more radical position. The Baal HaTanya says, let me see if I have it here. Yes, if you look on the second page, okay, I quoted the pasuk, the verse from Sefer Dvarim, which is used to justify this. Atahor eta ladat, ki Hashem hu Elokim ein od milvado. You have shown us that God is the Almighty. There is none but Him. Now, the simple pshat explanation is there's no other God but Him. But the mekubalim and some Hasidim took this to mean that there is none other than Him, that nothing else exists except God. Okay? Now, let's take a look at this piece from the Tanya. Okay? The Tanya, this is taken from the Shar Yichud Hemuna, which is a section of the Tanya when he talks about the unity of God and faith in God. I'll read it in English. Okay? This is a translation from the Chabad website. Okay, now, following these words and the truth concerning the nature of creation, every intelligent person will understand clearly, and each creature and being is actually considered naught, an absolute nothingness, in relationship to the activating force and the breath of his mouth, which is the created thing, continuously calling it into existence and bringing it from absolute non-being into being. If this was written in Sanskrit, it could be an Upanishad. You know, it could be one of those Kitei HaKodesh from India, if this was written in Sanskrit. Right? But it's written in Hebrew, okay? And it's translated into English, and it's Chabad, right? So there's nothing, it seems that they have Chabad houses in India, but not to teach Hinduism, right? So therefore it's actually really ironic and proves a very important tenet of my faith, is that God has a sense of humor. What the Baal HaTanya is saying, and in his understanding of the Tzimtzum, it's a foundational structure in Kabbalah, certainly from the Arizal in the 16th century onward, from Tzfat, is the process of creation started with withdrawal within God, so to speak, in order to make space for creation. A way to explain this would be, say, with our children. In order to raise our children properly, we have to know when to give them space. I don't know how many of you have adolescent children, right? I am blessed with a number of adolescent children at the moment, right? So the thing is, you have to give me space, right? And a wise parent, it's not as easy to say, it's not so easy to do, but a wise parent knows when to withdraw And we know that this kid is going to make a mistake, but he has to learn for himself. So that the person should develop, there's a necessity for the parent to hold back and to withdraw. By virtue of that, right? So let's look at God's predicament in creation, so to speak. He has to make space for creation, or else there's nothing, there's no room. We're not going to talk about physical room. There's just no room for anything else if God is everywhere. So God has to withdraw, right, in order to make space for creation. The way we withdraw in order to make space for people around us to develop. The Bala Tanya consistently holds that this withdrawal is an illusion. That in fact there was never really a tzimtzum. There was never really a withdrawal. God really remains everywhere. It just appears to us from our perspective that God has withdrawn. So it becomes a complicated structure of the universe where there's different truths from different perspectives. From God's perspective, nothing changed. God was always there. And from our perspective, we have space. Okay? So, but he says vehemently that there are those, they think that he's referring to the disciples of the Gra, that there are those who think that the tzimtzum really happened, that there really was a withdrawal. And that means there's a dualistic reality, that there's God and there's creation, and the tzimtzum was real. He says, these people have a lot of Yirat Shamayim, but God has to have mercy on them because they make this terrible mistake, which is foundational in faith. He thinks it's heresy to say that the tzimtzum was real. Right? But there are those that say that the tzimtzum, that God's withdrawal from the world at the initial stage of creation, is real. But he says it's not real. If he says it's not real, that means the reality in which we live is an illusion. That we can't see the reality, the true reality, which is only God, which is Ein Od Milvado. There's nothing else but God. Now, we're so used to, this is a table, and this was a real cup of coffee, and it wasn't an illusion. It did make me wore awake. And so what does it mean when we talk about the world being an illusion? That reality, not what we seem. So I'm not saying that I completely understand it, but I'd like to try to bring it home a little bit. There's something that Peter Berger, who's a sociologist from Boston University, he wrote a very important book called The Heretical Imperative. He talks about different levels of reality. And he talks about what we call paramount reality. And that is the reality of the waking world. This is a real table. You can really hear me. There are sound waves reverberating in your inner ear that you're translating into meaning, and that there's cause and effect. And when you do something in the reality in which we all share right now, there's cause and effect. Right? Things happen. Right? And we have a certain type of awakeness which tells us this is real. Right? And there are other realities. For example, we dream. And in our dreaming reality, while we're dreaming them, they might seem real, but when we wake up, we realize that the regular rules of the world don't really take effect in our dream world. And that's not really real. It's less real. But at times, and this is very important to realize, at times we can have a dream which is so intense and so revealing that when we wake up, it shakes us in a way that we say, I have to question what's real here. Right? It makes me question for a moment, and it might actually change my perception of what was the paramount reality. That there was another reality that broke in to my paramount reality and actually changed it and made me see that what I thought was real wasn't real. That's the best way at this point that I can explain what you can say about the world not appearing to be what it is. Be real, be scientific. Now, there are things that make you realize that as real as you think everything around you is, it's not real the same way you thought. I'll give you another example. Just thinking about this. Since we're talking about India, the Himalayas gain in altitude a few centimeters a year. And that's because the Indian subcontinent is still pressing against Asia. So the Himalayas, which are formed by that, every year, Everest is a few centimeters higher. So, but we don't see that. Within our limited, 70, 80, 90 years that we walk on the planet, we don't see any change. But if you looked at the planet in a context of hundreds of millions of years, the Himalayas would be like waves in the ocean. It would just be going up and down. So what's real? So we have a very limited perspective. There's nothing more real than a mountain, right? The mountain doesn't move, right? Only the mountain comes to Muhammad, but in generally, the mountain doesn't move, right? But if you take a different perspective, the mountains do move. They move like the waves on the ocean. Just it takes much more time. But that doesn't mean it's not real that they move. So reality is not, depending on, reality is really a function of our perspective. And that's what these teachings move us towards. Okay? I want to show you some other texts here. Mostly from Hasidut. Okay? But then we'll come back to something, some Indian texts. Let's see. In Parshat, I'm trying to. All right. In Parshat Korach, right after the Balatanya here. Okay. Do you see it on the second page? This is taken from a Hasidic work called the Mea Shiloach, written by Mordechai Yosef of Ishbitz, who he was a disciple and a comrade of the Kuska Rebbe. So we're talking about the first half of the 19th century. Okay, when he wrote this, I don't know, the 1830s, 1840s, when this was said. Okay? He said, in truth, however, God's will is that this world should be the world of appearances. Even though, in the deeper reality, all is in the hands of heaven, and the sense of human choice is as the skin of a garlic. He calls it a klipat hashum. As Eastern European, they ate a lot of garlic, right? So he uses the skin of a garlic, the thin membrane, is a veil that God created to give us an impression that we have, this is his take on it, that we have free will. Because if God is really everywhere and God is really in everything, then there is no free will. We're just, in a sense, projections of God's reality. So everything is, everything is just acting something out rather than being independent and making decisions. But we experience ourselves as autonomous and free. So that, he says, is a God-created illusion. God created that illusion. And it's like a thin veil. Right? It's very, what he calls the thin veil, the klipat hashum, is akin to what Shankara called avidya, ignorance. And in different places, the Mea Shiloach talks about this as ignorance, as ksilut ma'at, as sichlut ma'at, as a little bit of foolishness, right, that God injects into us so that we nonetheless do Torah mitzvot, and we try and we do good things, and we want to accomplish things. So why is that, if God is really everything? So there's some sort of foolishness that God injects in us in order that we should be active. Because if you were totally rational about it, and you understood that God was really everywhere, and even in your mind, then you wouldn't do anything. You would say, whatever God wants, God does. Right? But there's foolishness that God created, sichlut ma'at, that makes us produce things. It makes us creative. Right? And even if you don't accept this, you have to admit that human creativity, the desire to create things beyond our lifetime, makes no sense. Right? After you're gone, you're gone. But there's something that drives us anyway. It's sort of a foolishness. There was a very important book that was written in the 1970s, I think, called The Denial of Death. Where the major, he understands that he was a psychoanalyst, the neurosis of the age is caused by people denying death. All society is designed to deny the fact that we're all going to die. And from the simple things that, like, Coke adds life, that was a slogan for a while, right? You have all these things that really deny the fact that we're going to die. So but that's the sichlut ma'at. Right? There's a foolishness, and there's a klipat hashum. There's something, there's a veil over our perceptions. He talks about something else here, another piece, something else from the Me'ashi Loach, which is a very famous piece. He talks about Lech Lecha. Avram Avinu is looking for God. And where is he looking? Where is he searching for God? So there's the story about the burning house, and he comes to the house and says, the burning house, where's the person who's in charge of the house? And God appears to him and says, I'm the one who's in charge of the house. So what's the burning house in the metaphor? So some people think the burning house is the world. And some people think the burning house is history. And the Me'ashi Loach says something else. He says, Lech Lecha, right? He's, it's a play on words, go, right? But in Hebrew it's Lech Lecha, go for yourself. But he understands it as saying, go to yourself. God is telling Abraham, you're looking in the wrong place. You're looking out there, you're looking in history, you're looking in science to find God, all the medieval proofs of God. No, that's not where you have to look. You have to look inside yourself. And then the burning house, you see this piece here that I brought, the burning house is Avram Avinu's own heart. And it's from within the burning house that God reveals himself to him. I want to talk about, I have to choose here, between, this is a very powerful source, the next source, but I don't have a translation of it. So I'll read it and I'll translate it. This is from the Sod Yesharim, a Hasidic master from the beginning of the 20th century, the grandson of the Me'ashi Loach. So he describes the symbolism of Brit Bein HaBetarim, of the covenant walking between the halves, the covenant that God and Abraham struck together. And he talks about the symbolism, very strange symbolism if you think about it, cutting the animals in half and walking in the middle. So what does that symbolize? In the ancient world, that's what they used to do. It is documented that they used to cut animals in half and walk in between. That's where it comes when you talk about cutting a deal. We talk about that, and it comes and made it into English. We cut a deal. L'chrot brit is to cut a covenant. Because they used to cut the animal in half and walk in between. So the simple understanding is that it was sort of a curse. That if any of us transgressed the deal, we should share the same fate as these animals who are cut in half. Right? That's what anthropologists write. But he has something, he says something else. He says as follows. Shaya min hag, it's the piece on the last page. Okay. Shaya min hag lachtoch bal chai, the custom was to cut an animal in half. Vila avor bein abtarim, and to walk in between the cuts. Lirmoz, kishneinu mishorish echad nivreinu, to teach us that you have two people that are making a peace agreement, that we really are the same. Right? We all are created, it's a very universalist message. We're all created from the same substance. V'av echad l'kulanu, we all have the same father. El echad ra'anu, one God created us. U'badua nivgod ish ba'achiv, so therefore why should we fight? And why should we betray one another? In other words, we walk in between the animals. The body of the animals are the external reality. So externally, I might be black, you might be white, I might be yellow, I have slanted eyes, straight eyes. But that's all on the outside. That's the animal side. But if you cut the animal in half, the inside is the same. So the inside is since we are all the same, externally we may be not the same, but internally we're really the same. And that's why we're cutting a covenant. That's the symbolism according to him. But apply that to the case. You have Abraham and God walking through the cuts. So what does that mean? What does it mean if Avram and God are walking in between the animals which are torn asunder? It means that there's something about Avram and God which are the same. That Avram and God are the same. This is very, very radical in terms of what he's saying about the relationship between human beings and God. That in substance, they're the same. Now I want to read to you something from the Changodya Upanishad, which is, I don't know, around the year 500. Nobody knows exactly, okay? So the son wants to understand the secret of existence. So his father explains to him, okay, that's the background. Now take these rivers, son. The easterly ones flow towards the east, and the westerly ones flow toward the west. From the ocean, they merge into the very ocean. They become just the ocean. So the rivers could be individuals which flow into an ocean, and once the river flows into an ocean, there's no more river, there's just ocean. Okay? In that state, they are not aware, I am that river, I am this river. It is exactly the same way, son, when all these creatures reach the existent, meaning they reach the source of life, they are not aware that we are reaching the existent. No matter what they are in this world, whether it is a tiger, a lion, a wolf, a boar, a worm, a moth, a gnat, or a mosquito, they all merge into that. The finest essence here that constitutes the self of this whole world, that is the truth, that is the self, and that is how you are, Svetaketu. Svetaketu is the sun. Okay? That is how you are. And he says, teach me more. Very well, son. Okay? So there's a unity between the individual and the universal existence, which is very much, very similar to what the Sod Yesharim is saying here in his book. Okay? Just to finish up with one last piece. Okay? The previous piece, which is above the Sod Yesharim, he says, this is from a different Hasidic book, the father of the Sod Yesharim. There's this tradition in this family that comes from the Baal Shem Tov. Okay? He says that Baruch Kavod Hashem Imkomo, right? God is blessed from his place. Michlal de Mikomo, his place, lekam on the other. That means nobody knows the place itself. We only bless God from his place. And that's what it says in the Zohar. She'ein Adam Yodea, Shoresh Nikudat HaChayim Sheba'omek Lev HaAdam, Ma Inyanau Tshukata. Nobody understands the source or the animating principle. What makes you alive? And why do you have desire? And why do you want things? Right? What is that? Nobody knows that. Ki im haya adam yodea zot, if a person would know that, a person can't really know themselves. Then he wrote this before Freud. After Freud, I think this is pretty simple to understand. Right? That a person, you have all these things, you have all these things that you want to do, and you don't really understand what motivates you. But you say, so you have to look inside, see what is it really about to really know yourself. So he said, nobody really ever gets to the bottom. But then that's pretty standard. But then he takes a very giant step. Okay? Im haya adam yodea zot, if a person would know themselves, azai haya yodea gam mekomo dekut shebrichu, then he would know the place of God. Shehu shorash achin shel kol abriya. If a person would know themselves, you would dig down deeply enough, what would you find there? What would be the ground of your existence? That's where you would find God. That is very similar to what we have here in this Upanishad, which I just quoted to you. What you have here, but it doesn't appear to be like that. We appear to be here, and God appears to be over there. So that creates a certain type of dichotomy between what I believe or maybe sense to be true, and at the same time, my experience, which I experience in the world as not being God. So there's a certain the need to say then that if the world is really one, but I experience it as many, so then I have to introduce here an element of illusion, that the world is not as it appears. And the Hasidic masters, the purpose of your life is to work to get past the illusion of the many to reach this consciousness where you really experience it yourself as being part of God, in a sense. I say in a sense because it's a little more complicated than that. Okay? All right. So thank you very much.